Everybody, today's episode is brought to you by ASAT Camo, all season, all terrain. Our co-host Joe works with ASAT. We got to know him a little bit, and we absolutely love their cattle camo pattern. I've been wearing ASAT pattern for a long time as well, and I have all the confidence in the world with it. And so if you want to learn more about it, visit ASATCamo.com. Our next sponsor for This Is Hot Boga is Stoker-Eye Stabilizers. Stoker-Eye Stabilizers are made 100% here in America, so you know they're well-built. Check out their website at www.stokereyes.com. Our next sponsor is Black Eagle Arrows. James and I have made the switch to traditional archery, and we wanted an arrow that could give us the highest quality shooting that we could get. It's beautiful. Check them out, blackeagles.com. Just going to take a minute to say thanks to an outstanding sponsor of ours, Sturka Optics. They have the best warranty also. If you ever drop your product, get it dirty, send it into them, they'll replace it, clean it, and get it back to you. We've also been taking pictures with the optics and hashtagging them with Sturka Saturday, so check them out on our Instagram page, and also check out their products at sturkastrong.com. Next, we are brought to you by Seek Outside. Seek Outside has some of the best tents, stoves, camping gear you could ever ask for. We look forward to using them on some of our upcoming hunting trips out west, along with some of their packs. Check them out, seekoutside.com. Next up, New Breed Archery. We just hooked up with them, ordered a few RK1 recurves dipped in ASAT camo, which are absolutely beautiful. One of the good things that they offer are direct sales to customers, so custom-made bows for everybody. Check them out, newbreedarchery.com. And finally, today, our last sponsor is Northern Broadheads, all the way from Australia. They provide some of the extremely high-quality broadheads, and our buddy Adam is down there doing an awesome job, so thank you. Check them out, northernbroadheads.com.
Okay, you got to tell me what Hot Boga stands for.
So
that's a good question, John.
The background for Hot Boga was I had, you know, my wife does yoga a lot, and she was starting to do yoga one afternoon, and I'm like, well, I'm going to go shoot my bow. And then I said, well, yeah, I'm going to go, you can do yoga, I'm going to do a little boga out back. And honestly, that's as deep as we got with it. That's the whole thing.
That's funny. I have a daughter that's going to be a yoga instructor.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's a catching trend, so we figure we just go with it and see where it goes, you know?
You know, it might sound weird, but there was no other Boga on Instagram, so it was like a free username.
God, I wonder why.
So we got a big day here today, John. Jared and I have switched to traditional archery. And so my bow came in today, and Jared's actually got stuck with UPS, so it should be coming tomorrow. But I just this afternoon was taking some pokes.
He's really been rubbing it in all day, taking pictures. It's been a mess at work. Yeah. I've been crying to the employees at work, and it's just not been fun.
Oh, my God. That's funny. I started out in the 60s shooting recurves, and I don't think I'd ever want to go back to that.
Oh, don't say that. We're just getting started. Don't do that to us.
It just requires so much practice.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. I have an effective range of 2 yards right now.
Yep.
So if I get a deer that close, 50% of the time it's going to be a deadly shot.
Yes or no?
To be touching the target, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Even then, it'll be a gut shot somehow. So are we doing good with recording? Okay. Well, let's just jump right in. John, let me give you a little introduction, and stop me if I get some of this information wrong. So if I get these stats right, you've got 31 bucks entered into the Michigan record books, and so that's over 50 total record bucks, and then 19 of them are Pope and Young bucks. Is that right?
What? No.
No.
I've got 31 bucks in the Michigan record book, which means they were taken in Michigan, mm-hmm. and I have 19 Pope and Young bucks on my 22 out-of-state hunts. So I've hunted out of Michigan 22 times, and on those 22 hunts to knock on doors and free permission properties and public land, I've taken 19 Pope and Young bucks. So cumulatively, I've got 31 and 19, so I've got 50, and they came off 32 different pieces of property and from six different states.
Okay, so you're just knocking on doors, or you're doing some e-scouting. Do you use anything like Onyx or anything?
No.
You use plot maps?
Plot maps, yes.
Okay. And so, more introduction here. You've got three bow hunting books out, a few DVDs. Actually, I just finished reading your bow hunting pressured Whitetails book, which is really good.
It was
a great because I gave it to my brother-in-law as a gift for Christmas, and so I literally just borrowed it from him back. So thanks, Jake, for that.
That was my first one. The other two, I think, are better, but that was the first one.
Well, you got to start somewhere. There's the Eberhardt Way, I think. Is that one of them?
The second one would be Precision Bow Hunting, and the third one is Bow Hunting Whitetails, the Eberhardt Way, which, trust me, I did not want to put my name in the title, but my son, who co-authored them with me, kind of said we need to do that. And I didn't like it. I thought it was a little egotistical, but we did it, and that's the way it is.
That's branding right there. Okay, so your website is deerjohn.net, so that's deer-john.net. And actually, I just finished watching you have a deer and deer hunting YouTube series, too.
Yes.
Which is
called,
really good.
Public land and pressure deer hunting with John Eberhardt. And yes, it's a deer and deer hunting YouTube video series. And it's they're short, just little short topic videos. And I hope they get better. I spent a lot more time filming them. I'm not real happy with the way they were edited, but such is life.
Yeah, I mean, the information is fantastic. It's, you know, you read the book and sometimes it's like you're trying to picture some of the tactics and some of the things you're talking about, but seeing it on video, at least for me, was really, really helpful. So.
Oh, well, cool. If you'd like, I'll send you the link to that deer and deer hunting site.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
We'll post it too on Instagram. We'll post it a few places in the show notes too. So you mentioned you got into, recurve. Shooting a recurve, what was it? Did you say 70s, 60s?
Early 60s.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about how you got into to deer hunting with a bow.
It was very interesting. I was 13, and I was walking by a little archery shop in Ypsilanti, and it was midsummer, and there was the owner of the shop was in there shooting, and he was the only guy in there, and he was shooting what was called at the time a PA round, which is 20 yards at a 3-inch blue dot target. 3-inch bullseye.
Yep.
And he was draining it every time, and he was shooting a 62-inch recurve. And, I had friends, because none of my family hunted. So I had friends in school that went hunting with their uncles and squirrel hunting and raccoon hunting and stuff like that. And I was kind of infatuated with deer. So I asked the guy if he deer hunted, and he said, I've deer hunted for quite a few years. And I said, man, you must kill a lot of deer, as good a shot as you are.
Right.
And he said, son, I've shot it, and back then there wasn't a lot of deer, okay? In the 60s, there was hardly any deer out in the Midwest. Michigan didn't have a lot in southern Michigan either. But he said, I've shot at six deer, they've all been closer than that target, and I've yet to touch the first one. And he was draining that bullseye. He said, you put fur on it, and I just lose it. And that just, I don't know, I bought a 40-pound Ben Pearson recurve, and just started hunting and just kind of worked my way through on a learn by yourself process.
So he was kind of mentoring you a little bit, helping you with mechanics and shot mechanics and stuff at the beginning.
I never saw the guy again.
Oh, no. Nice.
Nope.
So how did you figure out how to shoot it? Was it people you knew? I mean, who taught you? Like I said, today was my first day with a recurve, and I feel like I'm going to need a lot of help or coaching from somebody. Who taught you that kind of stuff?
There was an older gentleman. For me, he was an older gentleman. He was in his mid-30s. His name was Leroy, and he kind of took me under wing. And again, I was a mid-teenager, and he was a pretty good shot. He shot a wing recurve, and he used to shoot some leagues back in the 50s, and he kind of taught me how to shoot with a tab as opposed to, leather glove, and he actually put a pin. He used to take a hat pin, and he would actually glue it onto the front of the recurve and use it as an actual pin, like we would use pin sights nowadays, because 99% of recurve hunters back then just shot instinctive. And I started instinctive, but I quickly went to a pin, even though it was recurve bow.
Okay. Yeah, that's things have changed a little bit when it comes to
just
the archery world. So you started in Michigan. You spent a lot of years. When did you finally decide to branch out to other states?
Oh, my. It wasn't until 1997. I quit bow hunting, I quit gun hunting in 1991.
Good man.
It just lost its luster for me. It just didn't do anything for me. So, during Michigan's gun season now, which is November 15th through the end of the month, November, I'm just sitting around doing nothing, waiting until December to go bow hunting again.
It's a free fire zone. There's nothing you really can do.
Yeah, and the TV shows were becoming pretty prevalent, and everybody, all the what I consider not too great a deer hunters on TV, they're all hunting in Iowa and Kansas and Missouri and Southern Illinois, where killing a open young buck is, it's a 2-day event. So I decided to start bow hunting out of state during Michigan's gun season.
Okay.
So that's 1997 is the first year I went, and I've been going just about every year. I've went on 22 out-of-state trips, and I'm 19 for 22. And I could have shot Pope and Young Bucks the 3 years I didn't kill one. My goals were higher.
Yeah. No. What was the first state you went to visit when you left the state of Michigan?
Iowa. Iowa was the first state I went to.
Was it the same kind of you have to draw a tag, or how did that? Or did that? Is that?
It was a draw.
Okay.
Iowa's a draw state. I think around 2002 or 3, Kansas opened up non-resident hunting, and that was a draw state as well. I went to Illinois in December a few times, and that was a draw as well. And then it's gotten to the point where Illinois has opened up more hunting licenses, so now you don't really have to draw. You can still buy leftover licenses.
Yeah.
And then I've hunted in Ohio and Missouri, which are both across the counter.
So if you're hunting primarily in Michigan and then you started hunting out of state, how did those two experiences compare?
Night and day.
Night and day.
Michigan's very difficult. Michigan has more bow hunters than any other state. We got about 320,000 annually. Kansas, first year I went to Kansas, I think they had like 19,000 bow hunters.
Okay.
And a lot more land mass to hunt on. So, I think statistically, and I've got all the stats in all my books, Kansas, every bow hunter, if you take the land mass, every bow hunter has about 3,200 acres to hunt, whereas states like Michigan, New York, and PA, West Virginia, every bow hunter statistically has about 40 acres to hunt on, and that's by taking bow hunter license sales and dividing it into land mass, and that gives you your absolute hunting densities per square mile.
So you've got a book that tracks this, or how do you record it?
That's
somewhere
in the book you read. Yes.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
in
yeah.
Every book.
I saw that table. Okay. Yep.
Yep. I have hunter densities per absolute square mile and PNY entry ratios per licensed hunter. So basically, like in Michigan, about one out of every 5,200 licensed bow hunters every year enter a Pope and Young book in the Pope and Young record book, whereas in states like Kansas, it's one out of every 149. I was like one out of every 200. And also the entry scores, the average entry scores for Michigan are about 127, whereas the average entry scores for Iowa and Kansas are up in the low 140s, which tells me a lot of people that, killing a Pope and Young buck out in Iowa and Kansas and Illinois, it's relatively simple. I mean, they're not that smart. There's a ton of them. They respond to tactics really well. The rut's real competitive, and that's why all the TV and video guys go there, just because it's simple.
Right.
They don't want to hunt in places where they might have to work at it. So, all those stats are in the book. So it's just much, much easier out there because there's so much less pressure, and there's so many more mature bucks because there's less pressure. They're allowed to grow to maturity.
So the mature bucks in Michigan because in order to live that long, they had to be more wary or something like that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, average hunter densities per square mile in Michigan are about 8, and that's bull hunter densities per square mile, and that includes the whole state. So that includes Detroit area, you know, Flint, Grand Rapids, the Upper Peninsula, that's just taking the entire state's landmass and dividing license numbers
right.
into landmass. So statistically, it's about 8 bow hunters per square mile. Now, if you take the UP out of that, because there's nobody that hunts in the UP, or you take Detroit and Flint and all these big, large cities where nobody can hunt, I would guesstimate Michigan's average bow hunters per square mile is probably around 15. And New York and PA and West Virginia would be kind of similar to that. And then gun hunter numbers would be double that. So there's probably on average 30 gun hunters per square mile. And in certain parts of the state, the DNRs put gun hunter numbers at 80 per square mile. So basically, if you're a year and a half year old antlered buck, if you don't learn how to avoid hunters really, really fast, you're dead.
Yeah.
Whereas when you go to low, lightly pressured states or areas where there's kill criterias, either antler or age kill criterias, you know, where bucks are allowed to grow to maturity, they're just much, much easier to kill them.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more of them.
Yep. So, yeah, you talk about Michigan being the highest pressured hunted state, and, you know, we're from Michigan, so we know all about that. We know about the high pressures. We know about the hunters. We've been on these hunts where we think we're getting in close, and just to come out finding that, you know, you almost see a pop can laying on the ground out there and on state land. And
it gets so heavily hunted. I mean, what do you do? Do you go far in? Do you go? How do you find where people don't go?
Totally depends on the property. I've hunted 18 different parcels of public land in Michigan. And I'm not, you know, for a podcast, I don't want to just say Michigan. Because sure. You look at Michigan, Pennsylvania, up certain areas in New York, West Virginia, Virginia, there's a lot of other states with pressure. Massachusetts, pressure very, very similar to Michigan.
Yeah.
So Michigan
just happens to have the most. But yeah, when I'm hunting public land in Michigan, I have a standing rule. If I can walk to a location, I don't care how much sign there is, I don't care how many rubs there are, scrape areas, doesn't make any difference to me. If I can walk to it in an upright position, I will never set it up because sure. I'm going to have company. So the only places I'll hunt in Michigan on public land is where I have to use waders, a canoe, hip boots, or something to cross rivers or water to access, go through a cattail marsh to an island, you know, because if you hunt in the same place as everybody else is, there's no reason for you to expect to have any different types of results. You have to be willing to put more work forth than the other hunters are willing to do to separate yourself from their success rates and make yours higher. You
sure.
just have to work harder at it.
Yep.
And you have to hunt different.
Yep. So then going off of that a little bit, how do you feel about the new APR zones that are up in northern Michigan? You feel like they're helping out or just kind of, you know, going against some of the older traditions of kind of the Michigan hunters?
Well, you know, I've kind of changed my feelings on that. They definitely go against the old school grain of, you know, if I own 40 acres and I want to kill a spike horn because it makes me feel good, that's what I ought to be able to do because I paid the taxes on the property. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of guys from those areas and people that actually go up into those areas now, and everybody seems to be pretty I think the percentage of people that are happy with what's going on is higher than the people that aren't. So, I'm kind of falling a little bit in line with it. I wish Michigan was a one buck state instead of a two.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's definitely helping. They're definitely killing bigger bucks up there. There is no question about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so actually that kind of brings me to my next point, my next question. So, you know, with all that in mind, last year, how did it go? Your 2017 season, tell me a little bit about where you hunted, what you saw, what kind of success you had.
Well, I hunted in Michigan, and I shot a buck on October 19th. I shot a Michigan buck, it was a 9-point, and it was at a red oak, which I had prepped the previous spring, because I do all my scouting and location preparation is done by the end of April for the next season. So I scouted it out in the spring, and it had scrapes underneath it.
Yep.
It was a primary scrape area. I think there was four scrapes under it from the previous fall in 2016. So I was going back to hunt that, but as a secondary option, I took a pair of hip boots because if those scrapes were not going to be active, I was going to go across a river and hunt back right on the edge of a bedding area where it butts up to a river, I was going to hunt that is instead. So when yeah. I did, I walked through a standing cornfield, and the red oak was on the back side of it. The scrapes were inactive, so I walked down the edge of the corn, walked through some cattails about 40 yards to the river, crossed the river with my hip boots, mm-hmm. and the tree that I hunted was like 20 yards off the river. And I shot a 9-point chasing a doe. The doe ran, came out of the bedding area and ran right across the river, never slowed down, right into the cornfield. And the buck came through behind him, her, and I shot him.
So you
that was about it. That was the only shooter buck I saw in Michigan the whole season.
So you found would that be considered during the October lull? Is that pre-rut?
Yeah.
I've not seen a lot of chasing October 19 in Michigan. How do you figure out a place to even find that to happen?
I considered that to be the tail end of the October lull, just maybe hitting the edge of pre-rut, because usually I don't spend much time hunting until like October 25th.
Yeah.
But for some odd reason that evening, and it was just a nice, beautiful day. It was like 65 degrees and sunny out, which I don't typically like that kind of weather. I like nasty weather. I just decided to go, and it worked out. And the doe was not in estrus, but I think she was close to being in estrus,
okay.
because he chased her. Obviously, if she would have been in heat, she wouldn't have ran
right.
150 yards nonstop if she was in heat and wanted to breathe.
Right.
So, and he also stopped when he got to the river, and that's where I shot him. I didn't go up to stop him.
Right.
He just stopped on his own because he was not going to cross the river. I think he was going to turn around and go back into the bedding area. So she obviously was not in heat, but she must have been close for a buck of that size to even chase her at all at that time of year.
How far was the shot?
14 yards.
Sheesh. Okay, so
just a chip shot.
Actually, that makes me kind of wonder how, you know, when you practice, so you're practicing, you go out in your backyard, what does that look like? Is that usually something 20 yards? Are you practicing at 60 yards?
I never practice on the ground. I always practice off of elevation similar to what I hunt from. And I usually have a target at about 10 yards and one at about 22 and then one at 35. So those are my three pins. And, most of my shots are 12 to 18 yards. That's what I set up for. When I'm prepping a location, you know, and typically I'm prepping locations that, you know, maybe an apple tree out in a lot of security cover, or a
yeah.
white oak tree, or a primary scrape area, or a transition funnel with security cover between, you know, two destination areas. So I set up for pretty tight shots. I'm not the greatest archer in the world, and, you know, I don't even like shooting 35 yards. That's a long, long shot for me. 25 and in is my comfort range.
Okay. Yeah.
We like to think you're a great archer there, John.
Yeah. Well, good
no,
enough. Good enough to put some bucks in the book.
Well, it's not the bow; it's the Indian.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's right.
See, exactly. My point. Exactly.
So, actually, that makes me kind of, you know, go into some of the one of the main things that I've heard you talk about is the wind and scent control. You want to give us a little overview of your approach to scent and wind and how you hunt?
That's simple. I pay absolutely zero, with a big ZERO capitalized, attention to wind direction. My scent control is probably as perfect as anybody's in the country. In fact, I've never even seen anybody with anything remotely close to my scent control regimen. I'm a huge activated carbon fan. I knew what activated carbon was before it was put into clothing, so I know its absorptive capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a huge Scentlock fan because Scentlock owns the U.S. patent on using activated carbon in clothing.
Yep.
So once I learned, and it's been about 18 years, I paid zero attention to wind. The first 35 years, I paid 100% attention to wind, no matter where I hunted.
Mm-hmm.
Now I pay none, absolutely zero. I set up my locations, and I hunt them according to, you know, the time of year they need to be hunted, the time of day. Are they morning spots? Are they midday spots? Are they evening spots? Are they early season spots? Are they secondary October lull spots? Are they pre-rut locations? Are they rut phase locations? I hunt them according to how they need to be hunted, and then according to the sign that's there when I do hunt them the first time. So, you know, back in the day when I paid 100% attention to wind direction, you know, there was some of my best rut phase spots that I never got to hunt. The wind was never right on the days I had off to go hunting. You know, I quit hunting saddles. I quit hunting ridges because wind thermals and wind currents just always busted me. Not having to pay attention to wind is a total game changer. I can't emphasize it enough, but, you know, for somebody to assume you can watch any of the TV people that talk about scent control and spritz with some spray or wear a scent lock jacket and pants with just a logo cap and their hair hanging out and a beard and, you know, a pack that hasn't been washed in 10 years, you know, those guys don't have a clue.
Right.
But because they're hunting non-pressured deer that don't get targeted until they're 4 and 5 years old, well, those deer tolerate a lot of human odor, and they tolerate tactics and stuff because they've passed by hunters with no consequences while they've grown to that age. So they have a lot more tolerance of human odor. And when you're hunting pressured deer that get shot at when they're a year and a half old, you know, as soon as they have their first set of antlers, and a lot of times it's button bucks with people with Dobermans in December, those deer are smart. And when they're 3 and a half years old, any foreign odor, anything whatsoever, even an ozone odor, will spook those deer if they smell ozone, because ozone is not supposed to be there unless it's a storm, after a storm.
Right.
So basically, I guess my scent control is I wear a scent lock jacket, scent lock pants, head cover with the drop-down face mask, which is tucked into my jacket, so your face, your beard, your back, your neck, your hair, everything up on top of your head has to be covered. You lose about 40% of your odor comes out of your head. I'd laugh at the TV guys. Even the guys that scent lock sponsors have no clue how to use this stuff properly. Anybody you see that's spouting about, I have a good scent control regimen, and their hair's hanging out, or they've got a beard and their face is exposed with paint on it,
yeah,
they have no clue what they're doing.
Well, I would argue, though, that most of Jarrett's scent comes out of another area other than his head. He doesn't have any hair, and he's got a stinky ass.
Well,
that may be.
John, I don't have any hair on my head, but I do have a beard.
So John, you would say for Jarrett, use a face mask, essentially one of those scent lock face masks.
Didn't have a beard, you wear a face mask. If you are not wearing a face mask, you are compromising your scent control. Absolutely.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, John. I'll stay on topic for right now, but I do have a question, and I was having a little bit of phone issues. Your scent control with the scent lock suit. How are you keeping your carbon suits activated? How are you reactivating them?
Well, the word reactivate really doesn't work, because to reactivate activated carbon, you have to heat it under pressure at 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you cannot reactivate. Reactivating means putting it back to its pristine state, which you, as a consumer, cannot do in a dryer. So I regenerate it or deabsorb it just by putting it in the dryer on the highest heat setting for about 40 minutes. And what that does is the heat actually energizes not only the carbon, but the molecules, the human odor molecules and whatever other molecules that are attached to the carbon. It heats those, and it makes them energize. And anything that energizes, it starts to shake, or it enlarges. You know, that's why there's expansion joints in the Mackinac Bridge. That's why there's expansion joints in concrete highways. When it gets 90 degrees out and the sun's out, the concrete expands. If the expansion joints weren't there, the highways would buckle, or the Mackinac Bridge would buckle. If you ever looked at the expansion joints in the bridge, they're, you know, tens of feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the exact same thing. Basically, the heat energizes the molecules, energizes the carbon, so it actually expands, and a lot of the molecules break free and exit out the dryer. And then as soon as the dryer stops, the clothing has to go in an airtight container, because activated carbon can't differentiate whether you're hunting or not. So it is absorbing molecules 100% of the time it's exposed to the elements. So putting it in an airtight container keeps it from doing that.
So,
and then once I go hunting, I change my clothes. Once I stop my vehicle, I get in the back of my soccer mom minivan with all the seats out of the back. It's like a little mini hotel room. And I change my clothes, open the side door, and go hunting. And when I get back to the vehicle, I take all my clothes off, put them back in their appropriate airtight containers, and put my street clothes back on and leave. And I have all my other clothes in airtight containers, too, my layering garments, my waterproof garments. Everything is kept in airtight, their own separate airtight containers, even my backpack. You know, a lot of people, I use an activated carbon-lined backpack.
Okay.
A lot of guys don't even think about their backpack. You know, they think, you know, I've talked to several people at seminars that, well, God, I'm using the head cover and the gloves, and I've got rubber boots and taking care of this stuff. Well, you use a backpack? Well, yeah. Well, how many times have you washed your backpack? Never. Well, how long you had it? About 3 years. Well, it's like a huge human Sentwick because you get into it every day with your bare hands when you're reloading after a hunt for the next time. So every little detail matters, and unless you've got all the details covered, it's not going to work appropriately. It's like a car. You know, if you have three tires, if one tire's flat, it's not going to run as good. You can't drive as fast.
Right.
So you're still going to get rid of, you know, it's still going to help your hunting, but is it going to make it where you can't pay attention? You don't have to pay attention to the wind? No, it's not. You've got to do it all.
Well, yeah, and I'll second that. And I spent 3 years working for a scent company out of college. And you want to talk about fanatical scent control. And it was incredible. We wore rubber gloves, latex gloves, with carbon suits. And we were still getting winded. I'd given up on it all, and I hunt the wind.
Well, what do you mean you were still getting winded with rubber gloves, carbon suits? Were you using head cover covering your face?
Oh yes, I was hunting with a man that you remind me of, and he reminds me of you. Very fanatical, but there's a lot of you know, just missing links in the armor that were hard to cover up. You know, losing, you know, hair, whatever it may be.
If your head was covered, you wouldn't have a hair issue.
Well, we were still, there was two of us, and we were filming. We had, you know, camera equipment. We had two hunters.
Sure.
Stands. We weren't using a saddle system like that you use. So, and we were, on occasion, not often, but on occasion, we were getting winded. Mm-hmm. And then we were also working heavy scent setups. And deer were working our setups. And working
explain what you mean by you were working a heavy scent setup.
We were working, such as like we were laying in trails, we were doctoring scrapes, we were mocking scrapes. We're just doing a lot of different scent work and actually working deer that would come into our setups and sometimes would hang out for a long time. We never got busted initially, but sometimes what they did, they got geeked up on our setup. And normally it was when they were downwind. I would think that, you know, a few of them might have caught me moving, filming, or different things.
Picture.
But, you know, I went back to hunting the wind is what I was doing.
I asked you what state you were hunting and, you know, what caliber of deer were you coming in and that were hanging around? Because I have a guy cannot have the greatest scent control regimen and still fool subordinate bucks and, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
When you're hunting.
Yeah, we're hunting mature whitetails in Pennsylvania in an incredibly hunted, heavily hunted area in southwestern PA, up into the mid western side of Pennsylvania.
Right, because it would be my contention, and I used to use scents a lot. To me in Michigan, I never, ever use scents. I think scents are definitely deterrent for killing mature bucks in a heavily pressured area. I think a mature buck or a really old matriarch doe, when they come in, if they're coming into a destination location on the merit you chose it for, and they smell, you know, some sort of scent that maybe he has some bacteria in it because it was bottled in July and used in November or something like that. Yeah, I think they're very leery of that because when you're in states like PA and Michigan where you've got 300 and some thousand hunters and everybody's using scents, those deer catch on. They've been there, done that, smelled that, and they know that's not cool. So I hunt a location on the merits I chose it for. I never booger it up with scents anymore. That, so, I quit.
Well, and that's how I hunt now. But at that time in my life, that was the company's end-all, be-all. And we were hunting mature deer. We had mature deer work our sets in PA. We actually killed several mature deer in heavily hunted areas that where other guys were not seeing them. You know, the typical areas, the big bucks were nocturnal. Guys weren't seeing. We've seen a lot of subordinate bucks, but we were consistently killing big bucks, seeing big bucks and having big bucks work our sites. Yeah, it was. You know, it's a long story, but we had a falling out, and I didn't agree with everything, but I went along with the program.
Yeah,
and but I hunt completely different now. I hunt more of the style that you hunt now here in PA. I was on mute, but I'm chuckling because you speak the gospel if you're hunting in PA, New York, Michigan.
Absolutely.
And if guys take note of it, I hope they don't, because I like my areas on public land that
we
nobody
do too.
Else wants
yeah.
to get to.
Well, and it's funny, you talk about scent control. I mean, two great stories, you know, that I have. First in Michigan, Jared and I, when we had to be maybe high school, we realized let's basically bathe in scent. You know, we carried a deer plastic decoy out on state land. We dragged the stinky rag through the woods of deer piss, and we climbed up our stands, and within like 3 minutes, like I'm literally, it's gun season, so I'm popping some rounds in my 30-30, and a little 6-point buck basically walks right up and tries to mount the decoy. And compare that to, so 2 years ago, I kind of got my brother-in-law into hunting. He was living in Illinois at the time. And so he, you know, the night before he sends me, you know, a Google image of where the land that he wants to hunt. And, he's like, what do? I got some scent. I said, well, you know, you don't have a whole lot of pressure where you are. That could work. And I said, what you got to do, and, you know, I pointed out where he's got to hunt, and I told him where to drag the scent, except what he did was he dragged the scent and then, you know, to where his shooting lane was, and then he continued to drag it where he was sitting on the ground. And so he's sitting there, the sun comes up, a massive, he called him the moose walked up, stopped where he, you know, sprayed for him to get a shot. He couldn't get his bow out in time, and the buck literally walked up to like 5 feet away from him. This was his second hunt, and obviously he didn't get a shot or anything. And I'm like, you know, why didn't you get a shot at this deer? He's like, it came right up to me, and then obviously ran away. So valuable lesson learned in the whitetail woods. You gotta stop the trail at some point.
Yeah, he should have turned it 90 degrees and took it to the side.
Exactly.
20 yards away.
So he, you know, that was a lot of digital advice that I tried to give him, but you don't even think somebody would do that. I want to go back, though, John. You mentioned ozone. So a lot of people use, like, an ozone sprayer, or they use an ozone cover scent on their clothes. Is that something that you don't use? You don't think that would work in Michigan or PA or a highly pressured state?
Or anywhere, no. For that matter.
No, I know lots of people have used ozone in that deer windy ozone, because ozone leaves an odor.
Right.
The first ozone machine that came out was Ozone 6, and they sent me three of them to try. This was 8 or 10 years ago, probably. Mm-hmm. And it worked. I mean, the ozone machine definitely did what they were supposed to. I made it an airtight tub, put a hose in it, took some nasty sneakers in there, and it definitely got rid of all the odor, my foot odor in the sneakers, but it left an ozone odor that was just as bad, just different.
Right.
And ozone machines leave an ozone odor molecules on the actual garments. And if you're hunting mature deer, I just will not take the chance on anything altering the mindset of a deer coming into a destination location on the merits that I chose that location for. So, I am not willing to take that chance. And I know a TV guy that is endorsed by an ozone machine. He does the one over top of his head.
Yeah.
And he said if it's dead flat calm, it works pretty decent. It still has an odor. And he's always hunting out west, Iowa, Kansas, right. Illinois. But he said if there's any wind, it doesn't do anything because ozone molecules weigh the same as human odor molecules. And so when they come out of the ozone machine, if there's any wind, it just drifts at the same velocity away from the machine as your human odor does away from your body. And also, ozone people, they don't tell you the humidity has a lot to do with how well ozone works. So, if it's humid out, ozone doesn't work at all.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I kind of changed the subject, but something I really wanted to talk about. Joe, I don't want to go on before you've finished your scent questions, but I want to get into the tree saddle, if we can.
Yes.
But.
Very interesting.
By the way, I'm not
about.
Paid by Scentlock to say anything. I've sure. just done this on my own, and I have deer down wind to me all the time.
Yeah.
I just want to make that statement.
Yeah, if it works.
Well, I think it's different strokes for different folks. And
yes, exactly.
What works for you that might not work for me. It might not work for Jared. It's definitely not going to work for Jared.
He stinks.
I mean, we've heard that.
Come on, guys. I don't stink that bad.
Wait,
never
I'm
say
sorry.
Never, right?
Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
Like, you know, attacking the wrong guy, James.
Yeah, it's just, thank
yeah,
you,
easy.
Thank you.
You know what? And we talked about this on our first episode that we just recorded, and we were talking about ASAT and the fact it's the mental. If you're comfortable and you feel confident in your setup and what you're doing, it will help you, and it will help you prevail. Confidence is key, and that's with anything in life, and especially hunting. If you go out there confident, it's going to help you.
And ASAT's a great pattern.
Oh, yeah.
ASAT's one of the best patterns out there. Scentlock's just never done anything in ASAT. They did something close. They did Predator a couple of years.
We don't talk about Predator.
Yeah. Yeah. I own a Predator suit, and I shot a couple of deer out of that. And a good friend of mine, Brian Schubach, who owns a sporting goods store in southern Michigan, and he was a huge advocate. He sold lots of ASAT. ASAT's a great pattern because it breaks up to your body figure.
Yeah.
It is. I'm sitting back and I'm listening a little bit more than I normally do because, like, these guys know I talk a lot.
We hold the mute really button very close with Joe. He likes to drag on.
I'm very interested in because – I'm invisible to the eyes. I've got the camo down with ASAT, and I talked about it a lot in the first episode, and I will talk them up and down, and obviously I'm working for them, and I love the pattern. I'm invisible to the eye, but I still get busted, and I'm pretty crazy. I'm pretty fanatical about my scent. And so I'm real interested. I like listening to your thoughts. And, that was my scent question because I kind of fell off of the activated carbon, the carbon suits, because of the reactivation process and the secondary contaminants, such as, getting dressed by the car, touching things with your hands. Because your hands and your hair in your breath are like the three biggest transmitters of scent. Besides, your armpits and your crotch, where if you're sweating and you're hot, it'll.
And I shave those too, by the way. During hunting season,
you just went there.
But I get it, and I mean, I know guys that go as far as shaving their head during hunting season.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you can take this to a crazy level that will cause divorce and heartache and depression, and I mean, you can really go far with this. And I really I like your system, and I like the way you talk about it. I mean, I've fallen off on the carbon just because of not being able to keep contaminant free.
You know what? I've got my system down, and I'd be more than happy to send you guys.
Yes, please.
Share these documents with people all the time. I'll send them to you. You guys do with them what you want after we're done. But I've got it down where if you and I were in separate vehicles and we pulled into a driveway, I would be out of my vehicle ready to go hunting, and I would be scent free, and I'd be out of my vehicle before you would.
Interesting. Yeah, let's send that to us and we can share it.
Yes.
Would that be something you'd be willing to share, John, with people? I think that'd be kind of a cool thing.
That'd be great for our users.
It's going to be long.
Yeah, that's fine. Actually, you know what?
Long means thorough.
So actually, I was going to talk about tree saddles, but you just made me think of a question. Before we get into that, you know, you go into a public land situation. Say in the preseason, you find a spot. It's fantastic. Do you go in there right away? I mean, knowing that there's going to be public land pressure, are you real aggressive? Or do you try to find spots that maybe you can hold off on and try to, you know, be a little more conservative with?
You mean be more conservative with as far as when I'm hunting them?
Yeah, or do you just go in immediately? Opening day, you're in there.
No. Typically what I do is when I go out, let's say postseason's over and I've got 40 locations prepped. Maybe I prepped 8 new locations that postseason and then I went and re-prepped or, you know, cleared out 32 other locations that I've hunted for a couple of years, whatever. You know, whether it be on heavily pressured private land or on public lands, well, then what I'll do is I will go in around September 20th, because Michigan's bow season is October 1.
Yep.
And I will check all of my quote-unquote early season locations. So an early season location is going to be at an apple tree with perimeter security cover around it and security transition cover to a known bedding area, so it's got to be in the right type of location, or a white oak, or maybe there was a primary scrape area someplace that I found during postseason, and I go back on September 20th, and on the 3 or 4 properties that I, public land and private land properties that I have to hunt, I'll do what I call a speed tour.
Yep.
Now, a speed tour consists of putting on my scent lock clothing so I'm scent free. I'll try to do it on a windy or a light rainy day so it'll dissipate the, you know, whatever my noise, basically, of walking around.
Yep.
And I will check my early season location. So let's say I have 40 locations prep. Let's say 15 of them are early season locations. You know, they're at apple trees, white oaks, primary scrape area, transition area between a bedding area and a feeding area. And I'll check to see if they are producing fruit or mast. You know, do the apple trees have apples? Do the white oaks have acorns? Is the transition from the bedding to the feeding area, is this year the feeding area have the food, preferred food? And if it has apples or if it has acorns or if there is scrapes, you know, I'll check for buck sign. That's why I go in September 20th.
Right.
Because I know the bucks that I want to kill, mature bucks are always the first ones rubbed out. Usually by September 5th, they're all rubbed out. All the bigger bucks are rubbed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know by the 20th, they've had 2 weeks to rub antlers. So if there's, if you know, if the apple trees drop at apples, white oaks have acorns, there's going to be some kind of buck sign if a buck's been visiting that location
right.
for 2 weeks. So then I would put that into my rotation. But most of my spots, and I only usually hunt the first 2 or 3 days of season, morning and evening, and then I kind of lay off until around the 20th to the 25th of October, you know, when pre-rut's starting. But most of my spots I hunt, I save for the rut phase, rut phases, because statistically, every year, statistically, 56% to 63% of Pope and Young bucks from every single state are killed during a 3-week time frame, which
right.
is their rut phases. So that's where I want to key the majority of my time. If 60% of the bucks are killed in a 3-week time frame out of a 3 or 4 month season, obviously that's where you want to spend the most time. So I'll do my early season hunting at the locations that had buck sign, and then I'll save the other stuff till the rut phases and hunt them appropriately. You know, like an apple tree is strictly an evening location. You don't go into an apple tree on a morning hunt because you're going to spook deer feeding at it before daylight. So everything's got to be hunted appropriately and at the right time of season.
Right. So when this... Go ahead, Joe.
Well, that brought me... that we came full circle, and that brought me back to my second question. And I hunt a very similar pattern here in PA. I will hunt the first couple of days, and then I back off through the wall until the rut starts to kick up. I use normally the week before Halloween when I start hitting it hard again. Do you do that only because of the rut? Because I do it twofold. I do it A for the rut and B because everybody and their brother is out hunting those first few weeks of October when the weather's nice and you got the bluebird days, and I just know in PA, all the spots I hunt, the mature bucks, they totally go into lockdown onto a nocturnal pattern and don't open back up until the rut starts.
Totally agree.
It's slow. I mean, here where I hunt in southwestern PA, the rut is slow to kick off for daylight activity just because those bucks have been pushed into such a nocturnal pattern.
Yep. Totally. I totally 100% agree. I think I've killed 4 bucks that make book in the first 2 days of season. So out of 50 bucks, 4 of them were killed in the first 2 days of season. That's a pretty low percentage for that. And typically, you know, when you're on pressured areas, just the preseason scouting, most people preseason scout and do all their location preparation preseason. So just that activity after the deer have been left alone since the previous year season, you know, just that preseason scouting and prep activity turns them nocturnal, the 3.5-year-olds are nocturnal before season even opens. So that's why odds of killing something early season are really low. And then their testosterone levels, when it gets into pre-rut, you know, their testosterone levels get high enough where they start thinking with other body parts than their brain.
Right.
You know, they're into sex.
So I completely agree. And when I hunt the early season in that first week, a lot of times I'll only do it if there's weather coming in, and or I'm a big proponent of the moon that I think it's Jeff Murray came up with the moon guide. And I follow that pretty hard for the early season if I'm going to put my nose in the woods.
Okay. Jeff Murray passed away. I knew Jeff. I'm not a big moon phase guy, but yep, Jeff Murray did that. I think Charles Alzheimer did a moon phase thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not so much on the moon phases, but on the overhead and underfoot to get a buck stirring to think about getting up, and then coupled with the weather front, I've had good success in the early season. If, like I said, if I even poke my nose in, those are about the only times.
So, I do like adverse weather conditions. If it's early season, the more adverse the weather, the better I like it. I like. Got a full opening day, rained all day, I'd love it. Because that's going to keep other people out of the woods, and a mature buck may move a little bit in the daylight hours if it's adverse weather conditions.
So I actually got a question for John and Joe. Do you guys see any increased movement with an earlier rising moon? Say, like, you know, it comes out at like 4 p.m. or 3 p.m. You can see it in the sky. Do you see that have any effect on deer?
An early season?
Yeah.
I don't pay any attention to moon phase on early season. The only time I pay attention to the moon whatsoever is when it's in full during the rut phases. And if it's full during the rut phases and the sky is clear, there's typically going to be a lot of midday activity the next day. Because when it's full at night, they don't move as much during the night. I think they are just a little bit nervous in open areas where the does are during night because it's just so bright. Now, if it's a full moon, if it's a full moon phase and it's drizzling or raining or cloudy, then I hunt as normal. But if there's a full moon and it's totally open skies where it's really, really bright out and it's during rut phases, I'll try my best to hunt the next day in the middle of the day from 11 to 3.
11 to 3. Okay, that's good to know. Write that down, Jared.
So a little bit of what I do in the early season coincides. Now, but what I watch for is obviously the weather, and then I agree with you on the moon at night. It definitely shuts them down. But what I really, really like is when that moon is underfoot midday following. And I've actually seen my biggest bucks in the early season in the middle of the day.
Yep.
I will catch them. Most of the time, it's around acorn stands where an acorn stand is close, where there's something close to security cover, and I'll catch them getting up, and they'll be browsing nonchalantly. It's a real slow pace, but yeah, I'm with you on the full moon at night, and I'm also, but like I said, I'm a big follower of that underfoot and overhead moon, and if it's underfoot in the middle of the day in the early season, that'd be the day that you'll see me sneaking out in the middle of the day.
Yeah, and deer have a midday feeding pattern. I mean, definitely. There's no question about it. Just like bass fishing has
absolutely.
Have a midday feeding pattern.
They do, and I find it in states such as PA, West Virginia, even parts of Ohio that get hit hard because we hunt the border, and we get a lot of PA residents that go over there as non-residents. I'm finding I'm seeing bigger bucks in the middle of the day, even in the early season, when I do venture out, even in, and during the rut. That's where I'm seeing my big deer, because hunters are
stupid,
very predictable. They hunt first light and they hunt last light, because that's what's been ingrained and taught. And you're going to see the most deer. You do see the most deer, but I'm not looking for the most deer. I'm looking for that deer.
Yep.
And I'm happier seeing one mature buck than I am seeing five lesser bucks or yearlings or, you know, 2.5-year-olds. And I'm definitely with that. And, you know, I watch the weather and the moon.
Let me interject something on that, because it's not necessarily, you know, I used to think that it was the deer patterning the hunters, but it's not. It's just older bucks are lazy.
And I'll go with that.
Older bucks, typically, even during the rut phases in a heavily pressured state like PA or Michigan, they're going to bed before daylight. They're going to wait for all the doe activity to come through between 7:30 and 9 o'clock and go in and bed down. And then because they're lazy, they can get up 10:30, 11 o'clock, and within their core area, wherever they have the adequate security cover, they can take the security cover and scent check all the perimeters of bedding areas and stuff like that, and they can tell where the does went in, you know, 3-4 hours earlier. And if there was a doe in estrus that went in, they cut their track, they just take off after it. So it's more because they're lazy and they can get up in the middle of the day and in a very short search within their core area, they can scent check that whole core area wherever they have the adequate security cover and feel comfortable during daylight hours. Yeah. And to give you a kind of a strange stat, I've taken 20 of my Michigan book bucks have came between the 1st of November and the 14th of November with my bow. And of those 20, 7 of them were between 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So more than a third, about 35% of my bucks taken during that two-week period were during midday, when I would almost guarantee you less than 5% of my time spent on stand was during those 4-hour periods, because I don't hunt midday that frequently. You know, maybe 4 or 5 times a season I hunt midday. So the amount of time I spent on stand during those midday periods was much higher success rate percentage-wise than mornings and evenings during those that two-week period.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I mean, and that's kind of what the old bull and the young bull standing up,
yeah,
in the pasture.
Exactly. Yep.
And I can go with you on that. I mean, I'm watching hunters leave as I'm coming in, and I could see it working for either way. I mean, I like to think that the deer are moving a little bit more because there's just nobody in the woods. And most days it's just me, but I like that, you know, the young bull, the old bull, and you know, I think the two work hand in hand.
Yeah, I do. I agree with you.
And especially in states that we hunt in the Midwest. I mean, it's just, I wish I hunted there every day.
No, you wouldn't. I have guys that moved out west to Iowa and another guy to Illinois, and they kill 140-inch bucks now, which was their dream to do here every year, but they're just another damn hunter out there, and everybody does it. Be careful what you wish for. You know, to go out and move your whole lifestyle so you can kill a 140-inch deer and just be another dang deer hunter in the mass is pretty much irrelevant.
John, do you... when you go west, do you hunt anything but whitetail? Have you ever gone after muleys or elk or anything like that?
I went mule deer hunting once and shot a mule deer. I went elk hunting twice and shot 2 bulls. So, and that was on public land, no pay. I've never paid down any place in my life. Everything's been knock on doors or public, you know, public land, free permission stuff. And dude, you guys wanted to talk about the harness.
Yeah, I did. I want to hear about the harness. Now, it looks like you're hanging from a diaper in a tree stand. But I know there's more to it than that. Supposedly, it's really comfortable. Tell me a little bit about how it works.
Okay, I've been hunting exclusively, and I would never even consider hunting out of a tree stand. I think they're archaic. But I've been hunting exclusively out of a harness, which is like an arborist harness, you know, to climb trees, or the consumer's guys that climb up poles and fix electrical things. you're basically in a fabric seat, and you're tethered to the tree in front of you with a lead strap. And they're extremely comfortable. Mine rolls up the size of a softball, so it fits in my backpack. You know, I can shoot 360 degrees around every tree. It doesn't make any noise because it's all fabric. I can hunt. I could have 100 trees prepped, and I hunt every one with the same harness that's in my backpack, so I don't have to have a tree stand for every one. I can use the tree as a blocker. You know, if you're hunting a destination location, like in an apple tree or a white oak or a primary scrape area, you know, you can actually have your body set up behind the tree where a deer can't pick you. If you're hunting out of a tree stand, you've got to be somewhat offset a little bit so you can, you know, if you're right-handed, you can shoot to the left to the destination spot. So, you know, when deer are feeding at a destination spot, you know, they're usually there for 10 or 15, 20 minutes sometimes at a white oak tree. And when you're sticking out on the side, if there's four or five deer and two or three of them are mature matriarch does, and, you know, they eat an acorn and then they're looking around and their ears are flipping around while they're eating, you know, your odds of getting picked are pretty high. With a harness, that doesn't happen because you always got the tree between you and the destination location. And you, nobody can steal it. Nobody can hunt it when you're not there. It's just got so many. The 360 shooting mobility is huge. I mean, that's just a huge advantage because during a rut, you never know when a deer, where a deer is going to come in from. You always expect, you know, have the expectations of where a deer is going to come in from, but you don't know because during a rut, you know, bucks chase does on unpredictable routes, so anything can happen at any time.
Are you talking about the Arrow Hunter?
Nope. There's a new one that came out. I'm actually hunting out of an old tree sling. I'm hunting out of the same tree sling I've hunted out of since 1981. Now, the Arrow Hunter, that one isn't even made anymore, but that same company makes something called a Kestrel, and they also make arborist harnesses. But there's a new company. They're going to start shipping, I think, this next week, and it's called the Tethered Nation, T-E-T-H-R-D-N-A-T-I-O-N. Anybody Google Tethered Nation? They have a new harness out. It's called the Mantis, like a praying mantis, and it weighs 15 ounces. And rolls up the size of a softball. It's very, very small, and this thing is going to be absolutely—it's the best one that's ever been on the market.
Interesting. Looking at it right now.
Yeah, I kind of want to get one. I feel like even for, you know, we go out elk hunting every year. Even doing something like that would be really, really handy. How long does it take to set up? I mean, what does the setup look like for something like that?
Well, if you're hunting on your own property, you know, let's say you're hunting a place where you'd normally put a hang-on tree stand.
Right.
Basically, you'd set a tree up in the same exact manner. You'd use either screw-in steps or climbing sticks or whatever to ascend to the spot you want to hunt. And then at the location you're going to hunt, you put a ring of steps around the tree. I'll send you guys this information, too.
Okay.
It walks everybody through every detail of how to set up one of these. But basically, sure. You put a ring of steps around the tree, and that's where you put your feet on. And so you can move around the tree at will and shoot any direction, and basically your feet are on, you've got each foot on a step and your butt's in a seat like a hammock seat while you're at rest, and it's very comfortable. You're more accurate because you always have 3 points of body contact. You know, you shoot typically with most of your weight in your butt and still standing on your feet, you know, unlike shooting off of a platform where you're just standing there with both of your feet on a platform. You know, you have two body contacts, whereas with the harness, you've got your butt as a body contact as well. And if a guy were gun hunting, because I used to use this when I gun hunted as well, you know, you use the tree as a rest. Basically, you just cup the forestock of your rifle or shotgun in your left hand, if you're right-handed, and just push it up against the tree. So you got the most solid rest possible.
Yeah, sure.
Now, these aren't like Cabela's or anything, are they?
I'm sorry?
Are these at, like, Cabela's, or where do you get something? Like, is this just online?
The only place you can buy them are on that website. They are not going to be sold in stores probably for a while. They're taking so many orders right now that they're going to be several weeks out if somebody placed an order right now. I have no monetary.
Right. I was going to say, you're not doing your job too well then.
No, I'm not doing my job. I hate charging people to endorse things, but I'm endorsing this Mantis. And because of it, if somebody went on Tethered Nation and entered my name as a code,
yep.
Eberhardt, Just Eberhardt, not John. Just Eberhardt. They get a 10%. They're giving them a 10% discount.
That's good to know. I kind of want to try that. I'd like to see it. I wish I could get my hands on one.
The godfather of harness hunting or saddle hunting, because I've been doing it. I've sat on saddle without question more than anybody else in the country, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we should look into
it. It's awesome. I mean, once you learn how to use one of these things, you will never, ever even look at a tree stand.
How long are you sitting in one of these, John?
Oh, God, when I'm sitting midday, that's an all-day hunt. If I'm in a bedding area, I'm in there an hour and a half before daylight till at least half hour after dark.
Comfortably?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
you can change your drape. So you're not sitting in the exact same position all the time. You have a drape adjustment right in front of your face, where if you want to, let's say, okay, I've been sitting in this position and my butt's getting sore because I have all my weight's in my butt. Okay, you can basically adjust your drape in 2 or 3 seconds where you're putting more weight on your feet and less in your butt. You're in more of a standing position, or vice versa. If you feel like you're more in too much of a standing position, you want to sit in more of a sitting position, you just let out a little bit of your lead strap or your drape, and now you're in more of a sitting position. And typically during a day, if I'm hunting in a 16-hour day, I'll probably change my drape 3 or 4 times during the day.
But you
only have to move it like an inch or two, and it makes all the difference in the world as far as the way you're sitting.
Okay. Well, one thing I do is get out there real early, and the other thing I do is sleep for the first 15, 20 minutes, or at least kind of like half awake. Am I in danger of falling out of this thing? Is this thing dangerous at all?
You cannot fall out of this. It's physically impossible. Nobody has ever fell out of a harness. You can't. You are tethered to the tree from the moment you leave the ground until the moment you get back on the ground, either with your lineman belt or with your tree tether, which is your lead strap. You can't fly. If you slid through the seat, you'd catch on your armpits on the side of the harness, and you can't fall out of it. Well, I fall asleep in it all the time, because when I'm in my tree an hour and a half before daylight during the rut phases, I just lean my body forward and rest my head on the lead strap and wrap my arms around the lead, the back side. So you know how a lot of times when you go to sleep you do that jerky thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I wrap my arms around the lead so that if I do jerk, I can't go side to side. And then I rest my head. The lead's coming at about a 45-degree angle from the tree to your waist, so you can lean forward and fall asleep real easy.
Nice.
How are you putting your bow up in the tree, John?
With just a little $1 bow hanger off to the side.
Oh, sure.
$1.
I'll usually have a couple bow hangers. If I'm hunting in, let's say, I've shot deer out of trees that were 30 inches in diameter where you could never put a tree stand. Or leaning trees. I've got pictures of me hunting in leaning trees that are leaning 15, 20 degrees.
Yeah.
So when I'm hunting a big diameter tree, I'll put, because I'm right-handed, I'll have a bow hanger 90 degrees to my left, and then I'll also put a bow hanger 180 degrees to the back side of the tree. Because then if I see an opportunity coming, and I'm going to have to swing around and be on the back side of the tree, I'll lift my bow, reach around, put it on the back hook, and then I'll slide over to the next set of steps to my left. And now I'm still in my sitting position, and I'm not having to hold on to my bow. I wait for the opportunity to present itself.
And you're hunting, knock, free knock, and then public land. And how are you scaling up? Because I don't have time to look at. I'm Googling as we're talking, but I'm curious as how are you ascending the tree.
I am typically always using screw-in tree steps. Obviously, on public land, you're not supposed to. So on public land,
it's frowned upon.
Cranford. There's a company called Cranford, and they make strap-on rope steps. And they're metal with a rope that just adjusts to the tree. Now, with anything strap-on, steps or sticks or any of that stuff, you're kind of limited to the diameter of the tree you can hunt. Like you're limited with a hang-on tree stand, usually. Right. You're typically limited to the diameter, or with a climber. So with strap-on stuff, you're kind of limited to tree diameters. But if you're using screw-in stuff, you're not limited to anything other than what you can climb on.
Okay.
And when you're prepping these sites in April, are you putting steps in and leaving them, or are you putting them in as you're ascending?
Totally depends on the property. If it's a property where I've got free permission and the farmer will let me, or the property owner will let me, I'll leave steps in. Usually, though, they want you to take them out. So, I may prep a tree in the spring and leave the steps in and then take them out at the end of the season as I'm coming down from my last hunt for that tree. Obviously, on public land and with strap-on stuff, I'm taking it, you know,
in and out, yeah.
every time, every hunt.
And that's where your book bag comes into play, your carbon book bag.
Yes.
And then are you, so you're wearing carbon gloves. That's how you're handling all this stuff at low level?
Yep, always have carbon gloves on.
Do you do scent stuff on your bow? How do you handle a bow?
The only thing I ever do with my bow is I wipe off my grip with scent-free, you know, like I buy Pampers or Huggies, you know, hypoallergenic, no perfumes, no dyes, baby wipes. And, you know, it's the same stuff as what you buy in the sporting goods stores. It's just a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I just wipe off my grip now and then.
Yeah, okay. So this podcast is going to air mid-September. So say you're talking to somebody about what they should be doing, you know, mid-September to prepare for, say, the October 1st opening Whitetail Day. What would be the advice you'd give them?
They should have been done already.
I knew you were going to say that, but
dang
I didn't
it.
Know.
No, the advice I would give them, I mean, if they don't have anything ready, obviously they have no option. I would go in the woods and I would look for preferred food. You know, during the early season, everything revolves around food. You know, when you get closer to the rut, everything, if you're after mature bucks, revolves around sex. So early season, go in and look for, if you're on public land, you're typically not going to see apple trees, but look for white oaks. And if there's no reds, look for red oaks with actually acorns. And if you find them, see if there's any buck sign around it. But I would definitely suggest getting away from other hunters. You know, don't just go someplace and, you know, you can have all the sign in the world is meaningless. I could walk into a spot and there could be 100 active scrapes and 50 rubs. And if it was an easy to access place on public land, there's no way I'd set it up, because the buck, if there was a buck making any of that sign that I wanted to kill, it'd all be after dark.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying a subordinate buck might not come in there during daylight hours, but the buck I want to kill, if he's using that site, it's all after dark. That's a 100% guarantee. So you've got to get away from other hunters, and you know, if you don't like everybody else, don't expect any different results than anybody else.
So it's food early season, sex, you know, during the rut, and then security. I mean, that's food, sex, and bed. That's what Jared thinks about most of the day. Is there any?
You read my mind,
you know,
Jimmy.
So September, you're looking at food. You're looking at white acorns because they're easy, the deer like them better.
Mm-hmm. Yep, white acorns have less tannins than reds. I would suggest anybody, when they're walking through the woods in the fall, pick up a white acorn. And white oaks are noted by, they have rough bark all the way up the trees and out the branches. Everything's rough bark. And the lobes on the leaves are round. You know, they're not pointed, they're rounded.
Yep.
Whereas, and also the acorns are about the size of a dime. A red oak tree is smooth barked all the way up the tree and out the branches, and the lobes on the leaves are pointed, and their acorns are about the size of a quarter.
Yep.
And pick up a white acorn, pick up a red acorn, put them in your pocket. Eat the white acorn first. The white acorn you will actually eat. It'll taste similar to a macadamia nut.
Do you eat the shell and everything, or do you crack it open?
Just the nut?
Yeah, just crack it open with your teeth and, you know, eat the nut that's inside. And then the red oak, as soon as you bite into a red oak acorn, you'll spit it out. The tannins are just really, really strong. Deer eat red oak acorns, but if they have whites and reds in the same area, they'll definitely gravitate to the whites as long as they have adequate security cover to go there during daylight hours. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're in an open timber area and there's a red oak over on the edge with good security cover, you know, the likelihood of a mature buck eating a red oak at the red oak tree, you know, just before dark, because there's security cover there, is higher than going out through open timber and eating at a white oak where they're exposed. So, but if they have the option with the same amount of security cover at either, you know, they're definitely going to eat the whites before reds. It's not even a contest.
I think I saw somebody that maybe Justin the Butcher, doesn't he bake with acorns?
He does, flour? We've seen him. Yep.
He grinds it up. That's.
I'll bet it's white oak acorn flour.
I would bet you got a nasty taste in muffin.
No one wants a bitter flour.
That's funny.
Okay, so, I mean, we've had you for a while. I'd love to end with maybe, I'm thinking maybe the most memorable hunt you've been on, maybe it's the biggest buck or something, the lesson you've, you know, the biggest lesson you've learned out in the woods. You got a good story for us?
Oh, my, I've got many. The biggest buck or the most memorable hunt.
Something that, first thing that comes
really
to mind.
Really long. I'm sorry?
The first thing that comes to mind, yep.
Well, the first buck that always comes to my mind is a buck that my buddy named Weezer. And it was a buck that I, first time I rattled him in out of a cornfield was in, he was a three-year-old. And I went to draw my bow on him, and my bow made a little tiny tick. And yep. I didn't even hear it, but it was dead calm. It was right crack of daylight, and he spooked. And when I let the bow up, I was like, what did he spook from? He ran out in this big, tall wheat field. And I drew the bow back, and I just heard this little tiny tick, and that's what spooked him. And I hunted that buck the next year. I had him come out of the same weed, this big, tall wheat field, and that's where he was bedding. And he came into a patch of red brush, and I was hunting at a primary scrape area along the edge of what was at that time a bean field, a soybean field. Mm-hmm. And then there's the creek, and then there's a patch of red brush the other side of the creek. And I saw him coming through the weeds, and he came into that red brush. And before he stuck his nose out of the red brush, he made a wheeze, you know, like a snort wheeze, but mm-hmm. he just wheezed. There was several does and fawns already in the bean field feeding. And this is going to sound like a crock of you-know-what, but that's why it's so memorable. When he wheezed, three mature does came out of that bean field, crossed the ditch, and started smelling the edge. There was about a 5-6 foot buffer of grass between the ditch and the actual red brush,
yeah.
And they started sniffing that buffer. And just like security guys for the president, kind of.
Yeah.
And by the time they crossed back across the creek, it was dark. I mean, he came, because it was real close to dark when he came into that red brush. So it was too dark, and I don't know. I waited like an hour to get out of my tree, because I never heard him leave that red brush. I heard him coming into it, but I never heard him leave. And finally, I just said, I got to get down, because I don't know. It was pitch black.
Right.
And I just got down and left, and I didn't spook anything. And then the next year, as a five-year-old, I went out there. It was a really windy day, and I only hunted this tree like two times a season. And I went down out there in the middle of the day. It was really windy, and I was in this tree. And this tree's like 30 yards from this patch of red brush.
Yep.
Same primary scrape area. This year, though, the crop was standing corn. It was standing corn.
Okay.
And it was November 1st, and that corn was still standing. This buck, after I got up in the tree, and I was up there about a half an hour, this buck stood up in the red brush. He was bedded in that red brush, downwind of those scrapes. And he circled around and came around to those scrapes, and I shot him. But if it had not been windy, he would have heard me getting that tree. There's no way he wouldn't have heard me, but it was really, really windy. And that was probably one of my most memorable hunts, because there was other times I had a couple other situations with that deer, but that deer was the other deer in the area. The does were kind of like bodyguards for him, and he was just interactive with the other deer, and it just kind of blew me away because I didn't think they did that.
Yeah, that's that. I've never heard of like a harem. You got your posse of chicks kind of clearing the way for you. Operation
yeah.
Human Doe Shield. Yeah.
Yeah, there was one other time that they did that exact same thing. He came through the brush and he wheezed, and I had tried rattling. So I had my rattle bag was on the ground. I rattled up in the tree, and then I lowered the bag on my bow rope so it sounded, because it was in standing corn. This was earlier that same year. So I lowered my bag down onto the ground and rattled it on the ground so the noise
sure.
came from the ground instead of 30 feet up in a tree. And he came out, and, you know, I hooked the bow rope up to one of my bow hooks, and he's coming through the red brush, and he stopped, and he wheezed again, and this time two does came over, but they smelled my rattle bag.
Mm-hmm.
They smelled my rattle bag, and they didn't snort. They just ran back across into the standing corn, and then he turned around and went back out in the weed field. That was just an interesting deer.
Yeah, we're going to need a picture of that the deer. That's amazing.
I'll actually send you a picture of me dragging that buck across the creek.
That'd be nice.
It was a mucky creek he had to cross. Not the biggest buck I ever shot by far, but he was a Pope and Young.
Yeah.
In Michigan. That was in Michigan.
Absolutely. Well,
awesome. My pleasure.
Yeah, I know what we say this in the introduction, but thanks everybody for listening. And this is Hot Boga brought to you by ASAT Camo. Thanks.